Krebs Hydration is a revolutionary product helping athletes across many sports to improve performance and recovery. Krebs is based on over 20 years of medical science, is an SA company, and is also a product that has great health benefits due to its prebiotic nature. Last week, Krebs won the prestigious Innovative Product of the Year award. Amazing stuff. And they were presented by the Australian Institute of Food Science and Technology. They went to some awards over there at the Crown Casino and apparently had a very good night. For more information, go to prepshydration.com.au. Hey guys, Bevo here from Sports Legends with Bevo. Bit of a different episode today. We're going to be speaking with Peter Dixon. He's a documentary maker and also a recent author of a book called He Was My Brother. It's about his late brother, Rob Dixon, past football player with the Hawks, also the first ever winner of Survivor. He passed away in a car accident back in 2009 with two of his young sons in South Africa. So we'll find out about that, plus much more on this episode. Well, what a great pleasure it is to have the one and only Pete Dixon on Sports Legends with Bevo for the very first time.
Thanks, Bevo. Pretty sure it's been a while trying to get to this point, hasn't it?
It sure has. We got there in the end. That's the most important thing. And you're over there in sunny Melbourne at the moment. You're living in Hawthorne. Great to be back to some sort of normality, mate, after a tough few years.
Yeah, definitely. I've got three kids, so yeah, lockdown here in Melbourne was brutal for a long time. My wife's actually a doctor, so her life sort of proceeded on as normal, really. She was able to get out of the house and go to work. She was a required worker. So, but yeah, getting back into some normality and getting able to get out and actually film and, interview and do my documentaries has been great.
And how you been going with the three kids at home, obviously doing the homeschooling with a couple of teenagers and a 12-year-old just said as well.
Yeah, the worst teacher. I'm the worst teacher in the history of teachers. The two elder girls was pretty self-sufficient, really. That was the school handled that really well at their age. So you sort of see them at breakfast and then you sort of see them at lunch and then, they get through their day. But Lukey, my boy, he was in grade 4 and 5 during the period, so that is tough. You've got to have a bit of a hands-on with that during the day. So, yeah. And, a couple of times I had a few projects going on, so I was working from home as well. And I remember having I did a sporting bubble documentary about the teams that were in Queensland at the time. They were in lockdown, all the different codes. So I was managing Luke. And yeah, I don't think I've ever been busier. And then you get cabin fever in the same time. So yeah, it's pretty brutal. Oh, I wouldn't have wanted to continue much longer.
You can see the smile on your face and that relief, I think. So it's good to see that things getting back to some sort of normality. And hey, let's go back to the good old days of when you were a young lad and you grew up with five other siblings as well. Tell us about what it was like in the backyard and no doubt some pretty big sporting rivalries there with Rob and your other siblings.
Yeah, six kids. So mum and dad, they always wanted a big family, but I think when it got a bit out of hand, I think dad wasn't too sure six was the answer. But mum was just, back in those days was the housewife, stayed at home. Dad played baseball for Australia and was a gun cricketer and footballer and sportsman. So when they got together, they sort of said, we're going to have a big family. Dad said, all right, well, I'll name the boys, you name the girls. So they got, but mum got off to a flyer with Sue. Sue was firstborn. So mum named Sue and then five boys followed. So when it got to me, mum put her foot down and said, that's enough. Oh, I need to get involved with the names here. So mum named me. But, yeah, it was an interesting childhood. We lived in Heathmont in an outer suburb of Melbourne and great memories of just being surrounded by siblings and love and, they looked after me and they were all older. So there's a five-year gap between me and Rob. 2 years to Don, Graham, then Sue, and then 2 years below me came Ricky. But yeah, many good memories of childhood, and it was just full on sport in our house. It was full on competitive, and that never stopped. still sort of goes. But we had all the sporting genes that were passed on down, and we've had some generations of AFL players and so forth, and in the family line. So we all seemed to get it. And one of my older brothers, Donnie, also became a professional golfer. So, yeah, it was all happening.
Very good sporting family. And no doubt it was pretty competitive as well, because I certainly had that with my brother. Whenever you played basketball, board games, whatever he did, there'd always be, you know, I want to beat him. Was that a bit the same as you guys as well?
Oh, it was full on. Yeah, I think my most, Rob was, my brother Rob, who's 5 years, was probably the one I was most competitive with, I think. And I think that's purely because of the age and where we were in the middle of the family kind of thing. But it was constant. Yeah, like we couldn't do anything. Like even if we were drying dishes, it'd be the first to finish it. We'd finish drying dishes first. But it was, it was ridiculous. And he was, I always used to argue that as a general sportsman, I had him covered in everything. But what Rob was very good at is he, the one thing I never got him on was he was a really fast runner. He was quick over the 100, and I'd always be a foot or two behind him. And I thought I was quick, which that annoyed the hell out of me, still does to today. He would, in other sports, if we were playing growing up, he had a great ability to just put you off your game at any stage. Like, he either make you bend over laughing or just dispute stupid things or whatever. And so I'd always find myself getting sucked into this Rob vortex of abuse that inevitably sometimes it would make him win. And it wasn't through any talent. It was just his ability to get into your head. I think that happens just growing up. I mean, he must have started that at a very early age. But, yeah, I mean, now he's gone. I do miss that. There's a lot of things I miss about him. But, gee, that competitive and that, you know, trying to better each other is definitely a whole. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. I remember my brother and I would do our own Uncle Toby Super Series at home, and we'd have the swim leg of Catapult, and we'd have the board leg, and then we'd run around the block and stuff like that. And he beat me, but I swear he cheated in some way. Just it was all good times, and I can see you laughing there, so you know exactly what I mean. Mm-hmm. But the passion for documentaries, when did that first come about, Pete? And what was your first documentary? Can you remember what it was and whether it sort of met your expectations?
My passion for it was born through Rob. Rob, you know, I just idolised Rob growing up, and he always had a Super 8 camera in his hand around home. He'd always be making stupid little films, little movies, and he'd get his projector out and, you know, splice it up. And of a night, all you would hear is the projector in his room. And he had a great ability to storytell even from a young age. And he would interview us and do stupid things. And he always had an ability to find humour in stuff. And so I was always sort of on his coattails a bit with that, just loving watching what he was doing. And then when he finally got to the point where he decided to try to make a fist of it, he actually did it on his own. He was in Queensland when he was with the Brisbane Bears. He was good mates with Trevor Hendy back at the time up there, and they made a video called Your Move, which was a first aid kind of mock documentary type thing of about how to go about it if you get injured or whatever in sort of certain situations. So he got funding for that, unbelievably. I don't know how he got it, but they that was his first real sort of semi-professional attempt at crafting a story, and he directed it, and it went okay. It didn't really go anywhere, but I mean, it's not a really sexy subject. He used to always say, first day, it's not that sexy. No one's going to get into that. But so then there came a time around the late 90s, early 2000s, where it was inevitable we were going to work together. We were just so close that I just took a plunge, and we both decided, let's just start a company called Hush Productions. We called it Hush Productions. Reason we called it Hush Productions is because we both went to the cinemas a lot, and we couldn't stand people eating in cinemas, or Rob especially couldn't stand people eating in cinemas.
Like hung on their popcorn and stuff like that. And
hates it. We just have to keep moving because Rob couldn't bear the person in front of us. So we were sort of brainstorming names of the business, and Hush came up in terms of Hush, you know, keep it quiet. And so we started Hush Productions, and the reason we were able to do it was our first series production was called Passion to Play, and it was Rob's idea. And Andrew Demetria at the time was the head of the AFLPA and good friends with Rob because he'd played with him at Hawthorne. So we kind of spoke to him about it, and the plan was to interview 200 past and present players, which back then was a monster thing to do. It hadn't really been done to that level. Yeah. And we thought, okay, we'll go ahead with this. We managed to find, and back then you could get funding for documentaries, which the person investing was able to get some tax breaks and so forth. That's all changed now. But through the help of the AFL and the AFLPA, and no one helped pay for it, but they helped us find investors, and we got investment in it, and we were away. So we had some influx of money to really start our business, and we just went full on into this 18-month project, two of the greenest blokes going around. But the thing Rob had in spades was ability to craft films already. We knew that. He had ability to engage talent, so his interviewing was first class. He had credibility because he was a player, and so everyone he approached would just say yes because they just trusted Rob because he'd been in the game and he'd been there. So that was a big thing, and we went about our business, and we just it was trial and error, and we interviewed over 200 players. That was the most extraordinary thing from all age brackets. And
well done. That's an incredible achievement, mate.
Yeah. So we're going around, and then Rob finally crafted it together. It was an epic. Like, it's like 3.5 hours long. It's ridiculous when you look at it now. When it first came out, it was released on the double VHS. It was like this massive. It's like this massive pack of VHS, and then it went to CD and DVD and. And Fox, back then, Fox Footy was sort of in its early stages, so they aired it. And, yeah, that was our first real big effort. But what it did is it sort of cemented our love of the storytelling, what we wanted to do. It sort of gave us the base then to move forward. And our first effort was really well received, so that's how it all started.
And what do you enjoy most about doing documentaries, Pete?
I love the process. I love the crafting and the creativity of crafting a story. So I immerse myself into that. So, for example, once the interview stages are done, that next period where I lock myself away in an edit suite and I'm trying to craft this entertaining story is what I really love. I really love that. I mean, there's a lot of you're alone a lot, and you're sort of in your own bubble, but that's where I think I love it the most. I work the best. It's funny, when it's all done and when it's released and you have to do the promotional rounds, and that's probably my least favourite part, to be honest, that I'm not as – Rob was the extrovert in our relationship, so Rob was the front man. I always sort of refer to it as he was like the lead singer and I was like the bass player at the back. So, and I was very comfortable with that because he had that charisma that was out front, and he loved doing that. He loved that. But so, yeah, when it gets to that point, I do it. I get a little bit anxious about it all, but I do it, and I know it needs to be done. But I do get to a certain stage once I finished a film that I do need to let it go to because I really immerse myself in it for my health reasons. I need to let it go and move on to something else. So the process of then following up for months after in promotion stuff kind of drags me down a little bit, but has to be done. But, yeah, no, I think the crafting, back to your question, is the bit I love.
Well, I've seen a couple of excellent documentaries in the last couple of years that I wanted to ask you about, and there's obviously so many that you've mentioned before, but Dare to Hope was one we saw recently about Paul Deer, and that was a phenomenal documentary. I know I messaged you about it, Pete, and I'd obviously, you know, being in the 90s and loving watching footy back then, and we spoke before off air about the dominance of the Hawks, and then seeing, you know, Paul Deer and seeing what he was going through, and also because you knew Paul through Rob being good mates with him, was this a tough documentary to make, seeing him go through those tough challenges, and because, yeah, it sort of gives a bit of an idea about how it all came about and what it was like doing this documentary.
Yeah, the toughest I've done by a mile. It Cherie and Paul phoned, and they were both on speakerphone, and they were talking about it and talking about their idea that they wouldn't mind documenting what was going on. And I hadn't met Cherie before, but she sounded lovely, and she's such a lovely woman, Cherie. But I sort of was reticent early on there, and there was a few reasons I was reticent. A that's the main one was I didn't want to throw myself into another grief situation, which I've battled for a while with my brother's loss. And this was going to be really close to the edge with that. And the other thing was, the other thing is just purely a financial situation is that you can get caught up in documentaries where you're spending up to a year of your life. And if there's no investment, there's no money, you're losing money. So there was this, how are we going to fund this story, and how's this all going to happen? So I was sort of pushing back a little bit on the, but Cherie is a bulldog. She's full on. When she wants something to happen, it happens. And through the pancreatic network and through her supporters, they found funding for the documentary. So I got a call out of the blue one day. She said, "Pete, we're off and running. We've got the funding." And I was like, "Ugh." And at that point, I still didn't think it was going to happen. And then I really was committed. I mean, I had said I would do it. And so then I had to it's tough. I sort of had to make a decision. All right, I'm just going to throw myself into this. So what I did was I sort of separated. I knew emotionally it was going to be really tough. So I had to sort of separate my emotions from the film and put a wall up to a degree, because I'm an emotional person. And when I first went and saw Paul and saw how he was, it was really tough. And I thought, gee, how am I going to get through the next few months of this? And so I really just had to separate myself from that. And it was probably the first time I've done that in a film. And Cherie, there was also COVID sort of floating around still. So there was issues of taking crews in and spending time with Paul, because the last thing we wanted was for him to get COVID. And so I gave Cherie a camera, and a lot of it I said to her, look, you're going to have to film a lot of this yourself. This is very intimate portrayal of what's going on. And it's your story. It's Paul's story. You're going to have to do this, a lot of the filming yourself, just because it's how, and I think the best documentaries are that. I think when it's raw and, they're not worried about a couple of crew or whatever in their face. So I did initial group of interviews with the family and external people. And a lot of the footage, we went in a few times, in and out, but a lot of it came from Cherie's own camera. And then it became a task of, okay, how do I put this together? And all the people around involved, the AFL and so forth, were wonderful. Channel 7 were wonderful in allowing me to use footage, because it wasn't a great budget. It wasn't a big budget by any means. So there was a lot of generosity in supplying footage and so forth to get it done. And then it got to the point where I was, again, as I mentioned before, I was just in that bubble of putting it together alone, in an edit suite, and that's where the emotion sort of really pushed me to the edge a bit. And the fact that he passed really annoyed me. It's so sad that he passed, but I really wanted him to see some of this film, and he didn't get a chance to. So that was really heartbreaking. It was a tough one. And I don't think I've ever had to do anything tougher than that. And the responsibility to ensure the family have something they're proud of was overwhelming as well.
Yeah, you did a wonderful job. Dare to hope for those people out there that are listening or watching, I highly recommend checking it out on 7 Plus. Cherie, you mentioned her before. What an unbelievably powerful woman, and the family as well. They just, throughout that whole situation, I just couldn't believe how sort of calm and how good they were, knowing the horrible situation that Paul was under and the stress that the whole family was under, and they just did so well, I thought.
They did. And the thing about it is people look at the from afar and go, Paul, dear to hope, oh, that's going to be sad. And it is sad, but the overwhelming thing about it is the positivity as well, I think, and the braveness of how the family coped, especially Paul himself. They loved their black humour. There was a lot of it was fun. Like the way he treated the journey to end of life. I don't think, I mean, if I could do that when it comes to, I would be thrilled that I sort of would handle it in the manner that he did and they did. He prepared his children, he prepared his wife for what was to happen. They made sure that every day they lived, they were going to enjoy and love each other and get the most out of every minute. And they did that. There was no feeling sorry for themselves, which is extraordinary. I don't know how they did that. And so my overwhelming joy about this film at the end was when you sit back and I looked at it again about 2 months after I last saw it, a few weeks ago. And it felt like I hadn't made it. I hadn't been involved in it at all. I just sat back and looked at it again. And all the overwhelming thing I got out of it was how positive they were and how well they went about that period in their lives. And sure, the pain that follows is always going to happen. But for Paul, right up to the end, he had a loving, embracing family. He lived life as well as he could to the end. He was fulfilled and content. And that is extraordinary, I think.
I think you've absolutely nailed it there. I was blown away as well by how calm and controlled they were throughout such a difficult situation. And you're right, you know, no one likes to talk about death, and it's all something that's inevitable for all of us. But the way they handled it and the way they were just that live life to the fullest situation, it's inspiring stuff. And yeah, I'm sure he would have been extremely proud, Pete, if he was to see that.
Thanks, mate. Yeah, it was funny because when I was putting it together, I thought one of the questions I remember throwing to him was, you know, and it's pretty brutal, but I mean, he was really keen just to be an honest. And there was nothing that he said, don't hold back, you know, whatever you want to ask us. So I did ask very early on about, do you fear death? And the response was so powerful. I started the film with it and he just said, nah. And it was so, as the person asking the question, I remember feeling it straight away at ease. He was making me feel at ease, which was ridiculous. But he said, nah. And he sort of had a little smirk on his face. And he said, well, what are you going to be scared of? Like, no one's come back and told me there's anything to be scared of. And it was one of the great lines. And I thought, that's true. Like, no one's actually – so what are you scared of? And so I think what he made me do, and I think what the film makes you do, is it makes you just think a little bit deeper about things. And I think you'd agree. But I think you sort of sit back and, you know, it makes you feel grateful for what you've got and ideally not to fear what is in store. And I think that's what it did.
You mentioned before the emotional side of things. Going through all that footage, was there anything that you had to take out because it being too emotional or because the family sort of wanted you to take out of it?
I had to be very mindful of Cherie and what was and her kids, and because they didn't filter anything when they were filming at home. That was full on. There was nothing that they didn't say, oh, no, we're not going to use that. So she supplied me the raw vision. So you look at it and go, oh, you know, it's really personal and really. So there were some elements that, of course, we just thought, did the public really need to see that? And so you sort of get pushed that aside. And then, but in saying that, in the end, Cherie got to the point where this is it. Let's just tell it as it is. This is how it. I mean, and there was very little pushback on some of the more deeply personal things that happened. And near the end, when you see Paul talking to the family, he's close to the end, and he's telling them how he feels about them. And I mean, Cherie, to her credit, that's something that I would find really difficult to release if it was me. But she saw it as part of a really important part of the whole overall story, that people see this and see the realities of it. And so all credit to her for that. But I'd have to really dig deep. I'm sure there were some things that were left on the floor that always should be, and that's for them. But I can't really remember anything really stand out that she was adamant about keeping out, no.
We were just talking before about, obviously, Rob and that incredible bond that you both had and you touched about earlier, growing up playing sport against each other and enjoying life as a typical brother and sibling. So you've written a book called He Was My Brother, and it's about your brother Rob and that incredible bond that you had together. And obviously in 2009, sadly passed away in a car accident in South Africa with his young son. tell us about the book, the idea behind it, and why you wanted to do it, Pete.
Yeah, so in 2009, Rob was in South Africa and he had a car accident, and he actually lost both. He had two sons. He lost both sons in the accident as well. So it was, yeah, a tragedy that rocked our family, and it really, yeah, I've battled a lot since with some issues and grief, suppressing grief, and so a lot of what happened post, I got to the point where I thought I've got a part of my healing was to write about his story, and I put it off and I put it off. I was initially thinking of a documentary, but I sort of, and that may well happen in the future, but even right now, that's too hard for me to contemplate because it means I've got to speak on camera and, you know, get family on, and I think that's just a bit too difficult. So my first thought was, I'm going to write his story down and our story down, and that was just for me, really, to help get through some issues that I had. But it came about early this year. I just said to my wife, I said, I'm in a space now where I'm going to write this book. And I just sat down and it flooded out. And I didn't know I can write documentary structures, and I can write in terms of the filmmaking aspect. But in terms of writing a book, I've never written a book before. So I remember Dad saying to me, "Can you write a book?" I'm going, "I don't know." He's like, "How do you do it?" Like, Dad was getting all, you know, do you use a pen? And he's getting ridiculous with stupid questions. And I remember sitting down at my computer, and I basically just spent 10 weeks writing, and it just all flooded out. And I obviously had it all in my head, but it was really therapeutic for me. And it's a story about Rob and his life and the extraordinary things he achieved in his life, but it's also a story about grief and mental health, and how in my circumstance, how not to go about it, really, because I didn't go about it that well. But so there's a whole lot of elements to this book that I wasn't aware was happening as I was writing. I was just writing it out, and then it got into the hands of a few mentors of mine who have written books, and suddenly it sort of went from here to there to publishers wanting it, and then it sort of happened, and which was never the plan for me. But I'm happy it is, because I want Rob's story read, and I'm happy people are enjoying it, and it's going well. It's just difficult to look at it now and think that I actually did it. It's one of those things that, again, you sort of step out of yourself and go, did I do that? Like, it's a bit of a ride, the story. It takes us through our youth, and Rob had some extraordinary achievements in life. Rob was a 17-year-old helicopter pilot. At one stage, he was the youngest pilot in the country. And, I mean, that's just ridiculous. He was flying helicopters before he could drive a car. Jeez. So we were up in helicopters with him, and I was going, "This can't be right." just shitting myself. Thought, "This is going to crash here." Yeah, he had this ability to, I mean, he was school captain of the college we were at. He was just this charismatic, and it was funny, the other day, someone close to him said he was just annoyingly charismatic, you know. It was a really, you shouldn't annoy them. Good looking, and then he sort of went on to play AFL footy. Then he was also a missionary at one point, because he was, unbeknownst to a lot of people early on, he was very religious, Rob, a product of our mum, and then he won Australian Survivor, the first Australian TV series, which was just, for me, it was always a lock. As soon as he got on, I just knew he'd win it. Like, he was just one of those guys that you just go, okay, he's going to win that, annoyingly. you know, and then his filmmaking sort of went to another level. So his impact on a lot of people was profound, and this book sort of brought back a lot of memories of that. And well, even when I was over in South Africa and we were dealing with the aftermath, I didn't realise the level of Rob's impact here in the football world especially, but in the sporting world. And, you know, when the memorial came around in Melbourne, there was like 1,000 people that was crammed in. They couldn't fit. I was staggered by the response back here. And Yeah, he left a very big footprint on a lot of people, and so I just wanted to go back and celebrate his life and also throw in, you know, some of the issues that people deal with grief.
And where can people buy the book, Peter, the He's My Brother book?
You can wander in to any store, and if it's not on the shelves, you just request it and I'll get it in for you. It's also online if you look online, but I've also got a bunch of copies for your listeners if they want to go direct to Dixon Films, www.dixonfilms.com.au. That's the quickest right now, and you'll get one out the next couple of days, and it's on the homepage there. So
sensational. I can't wait to have a read. And what's next for Peter Dixon? Obviously, you've done so much already in your young years, mate. What's to look forward to next?
There's a few things that are in the pipeline for next year, but again, I've got to the point where I have become a little bit choosy in what I want to do. There's so many elements that go into documentaries, and I wrote in the book, I talk about the docos a lot in the book, and a lot of it comes down to the right time in your life of what the story is, financial, whether it's funded or not, which is always a difficult process, getting harder and harder, where it'll end up. So there's a few ideas that are floating around, and I'm sort of, when I finish a documentary, I sort of spend a month or two just getting myself back in order. I'm in that month or two right now because it's only recent that Paul Deer's finished. And I look back on this year and I think I've done that Paul Deer and I've written a book. I've had a pretty full-on year, so I'm just sort of assessing what I'll do next. And it's for documentary makers, getting towards the end of the year, it's always a bit quiet anyway, so we'll see what happens.
Well, we look forward to seeing what's next. And another documentary that I highly recommend people should watch as well, which I saw recently, was The Ripple Effect. We can speak about that another time, because that's a one for another day, because it's a wonderful documentary and one that we could speak about for many, many hours. But yeah, that's another highly recommended one, I think. And good job for you creating that one as well, Pete.
That was special. That was with Nathan Lovett Murray and focused on racism and the effects on mental health. We had Nova Peris and a bunch of great athletes on the show, Josh Adokar, and it was, for me, it was a real eye opener. I mean, I don't live what they go through, so it actually won an Australian Sports or Documentary Award, which was really fulfilling for everyone involved. And
congratulations, that's huge.
We're up in Sydney at the start of the year, and yeah, it's going well, and the proudest thing I'm proud of that is Nathan's continued on. We shortened the version to a 15-minute version. It's an hour film, but a 15-minute version, or 43-minute hour of TV film. And there's a 15-minute version that Nathan now goes out across schools across the country and called Point and Be Proud, and uses the 15-minute film as part of the presentation to kids across the country about racism and the effects of it, and it's really powerful, and he's doing a wonderful job. So that's probably the most pleasing aspect of it. It's got a life, it's continuing on.
Yeah, it's another one you should be extremely proud of, Peter. And yeah, like you said before, racism is such a hot topic at the moment, and it's really good to see that there's all these people, these Indigenous people, whether it be AFL players, NRL players, whatever it might be, past and present, that have got behind this. And yeah, it's super exciting, and just can't wait to see what's next for Peter Dixon. And thanks so much for chatting today with us on Sports Legends with Bevo. Well done on everything you've done so far, and I can't wait to read the book as well, He's My Brother. Go on to Peter Dixon Films and get yourself a copy of that one. And we look forward to speaking again in the future, mate.
Oh, Bevo, I appreciate it. I love chatting, and next time won't take so long. I promise we'll get there.
Look forward to it.
Thanks, Bevo.
Thanks, mate. Good on you.
My brother Rob is probably the one I was most competitive with, I think. And I think that's purely because of the age and where we were in the middle of the family kind of thing. But Oh, it was constant. Yeah, like we couldn't do anything. Like even if we were drying dishes, it'd be the first to finish. And we'd finish drying dishes first.